Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're moving into the 20th century. And as it were, the roads become in many senses the history of the motor car. Now, one can begin in all sorts of worthy ways, but let us begin with the great work of literature, which sums it up. A work, alas, that didn't win the Nobel Prize, but which has lasted much longer than most of those that had. And I'm referring, of course, to The Wind in the Willows, Kenneth Graham's novel for adults, as well as under the pretense of being children, that came out in 1908. Mr. Toad, that central character, somebody that summarises Englishness for all of us, with his zeal for novelty, captures the appeal of the motor car. It appears to offer unconstrained power and to give individuality its head. And I enormously enjoyed looking up my copy of this. Well, I've actually got two copies of it, to make sure I got the quotes right. So we get the magnificent motor car, immense, breath-snatching, passionate, with its pilot tense and hugging his wheel, possessed all earth and air for the fraction of a second. Toad is captured and becomes, quote, the terror of the highway. As if in a dream, he pulled the lever and swung the car round. All sense of right and wrong, all fear of obvious consequences, seemed temporarily suspended. He was only conscious that he was Toad once more, Toad at his best and highest, Toad the terror, the traffic queller, the lord of the lone trail, before whom all must give way or be smitten into nothingness and everlasting night. Virginia Woolf, eat your heart out. Now, Graham presented a transport system in transition, which indeed had been the situation from at least the end of the 17th century. So the story sees just about every transport system then possible apart from aircraft. It begins with mole going on a walk. It continues with mole and rat boating by means of rowing, i.e. their own efforts, and then moves on to their visiting toad, who presents a real, who presents a horse-pulled caravan, and they all go on that, but disaster ensues at the hands of a fast car when they meet their first high road. Now, there are other means of transport in the story, including a train whose driver, quote, doesn't hold with motor cars, a canal barge, and that brings up to the motor car again. Selling the horse to a gypsy, Toad gets a lift in a car, drives it too fast, causing it to crash into a horse pond and escapes anew. All very dramatic. But of course, if you turn to some contemporaries, some of their adventures are quite interesting, not as dramatic as Toad's, of course, but quite interesting. I found the account of an Ella MacLean, who was born in Felling, County Durham, in 1894, and who subsequently, when she was an out of some years, described transport before World War One. She went on family outings in a pony and trap, as so many families who could afford to do so did, and quote, our first motor car at Gosforth. Ginny is the pony, was terrified and reared up, and Tom and Stuart had to jump out and hold her head. She was shaking with fear at the monster she had met. Well, not quite Toad, but it gives you a sense, again, of change coming and of the motor car producing trains. Now, it has to be said that if you're looking in the 1800s and the early, 1900s and the early 19-teens, it's still, on the whole, railways. And the car is, in a sense, more local. So if you take another novel, John Buchan's successful adventure novel, The 39 Steps, in which Richard Hannay, boarding a moving train at St. Pancras, a staple of such works, and then roaring through the northern tunnels of London, reaches Scotland, he steals a car, just like Mr. Toad, only to discover, quote, the risk of getting onto a farm road and ending in a duck pond. Hannay is tracked by an aircraft and runs his car into a hedge to avoid another one. So the car is, as it were, not the central way you get around the country. The way you get around the country remains the train, but the car is becoming more important and crucially is becoming part of the imaginative sort of panoply of transport as far as fiction is concerned, and of course, very rapidly soon in the 1920s, as far as films are concerned. The prominent, of course, can readily take cars, particularly if there's railway problems. So, finding himself cut off in Balmoral in Scotland, George V, during the 1919 National Rail Strike, felt his royal office drifting out of control. He couldn't get any letters, and he returned to the capital by car. And in fact, George V took the car quite frequently, again during the general strike of 1926. Emerging road transport ensured food deliveries. And indeed, I think it's fair to say that but for road transport, the government would have found it far harder to oppose the strike, the general strike, because the rail unions were quite militant. And again, I'm not sure that's an element that has been brought out adequately. In the interwar years, of course, the cars are spreading, as are lorries. And owing to sort of relatively inexpensive lorries and petrol, to low taxation on the wages, capital, and profits of road hauliers, to the fact that they didn't have the unionisation of the politicised unionisation of rail, and that they had no need for road construction or maintenance, road hauliers acquired a major advantage over rail transport for freight. So also with their ability to set their own prices and wages, and the lack of any obligation to be common carriers, which could entail unprofitable loads for rail companies. Lorries also served many of the booming industries of the period, for example, moving housing materials such as bricks from central sites in order to provide the houses being put up in suburbia. Lorries more generally could readily move materials from warehouses, and these warehouses proved more efficient than marshalling yards, many of which had legacy problems, including cramped sites and unionised and difficult workforces. Road freight warehousing required less space. Furthermore, other aspects of the road directly competed with rail. For example, buses competed with railways to transport people. And buses are often ignored in the interwar years. People talk about the rise of the motor car. Actually, buses were very important. They offered a flexibility that trains generally lacked, not least with the ability to put in special services. Running a special could be done by bus as well as by train, and the resulting possibility for tapping potential demands. So trains, as a result, had to share excursion business. Buses competed with railways to take people to the new holiday camps, such as the Butlins Camp, opened in Skegness in 1937. On top of that, car production is is increasing. They rose from 116,000 cars made in 1924 to 341,000 in 1938. By when there were nearly 2 million cars, there were 500,000 road goods vehicles, some of which indeed were diesel powered from the early 1920s. And there were 53,000 buses and coaches. George Bernard Shaw, who liked to think he was perceptive on social change, captured the appeal in the first act of his 1929 play, The Apple Cart, quote, "What Englishman will give his mind to politics as long as he can afford to keep a motor car?" It's an interesting comment and worth thinking about at the present day. Thanks, for example, to the Morris Works at Cowley, Oxford had only 5% unemployment in 1934. That's at the height of the Depression. And the car factories in Oxford, indeed, employed 10,000 people in 1939, producing on the American model that William Morris sought to copy from Henry Ford. Morris was also influenced by all steel car bodies. Now, if you look at the literature of the interwar years and the reporting in newspapers, you will see plentiful comments about the cars and much less whimsical in a way than the ones prior to World War One. So T.S. Eliot's dystopian poem, The Wasteland, in 1922, referred to, quote, the sound of horns and motors as becoming more insistent. On the 4th of October, 1923, the Times complained about the overdevelopment of the seaside, writing, at first, muddy paths were replaced by sound roads, but then the roads became asphalt esplanades, the same fate overtaking the use of the motor car. The idea began to run away with its promoters. Little by little, the greater roads began to lose all semblance of the rural. A decade or two more, and we must search the wilds of distant countries for a truly county road. Well, I don't think that's very true, but nevertheless, it created this sense of things changing. Detective novels increasingly focused on cars rather than the more traditional trains. Edith Caroline Rivett, writing as E.C.R. Lorack, a great detective novelist who has been ignored. I've written about her quite extensively in my monthly Murders for January, February, March, etc., which The Critic carries on its website, and which, you know, for those of you interested in detective novels, I would recommend. Anyway, in her successful Death on the Oxford Road of 1931, recently reprinted, began the novel with Peter Vernon remarking, "The only object of running a car nowadays is that it makes you independent of railway timetables. Motoring for pleasure is a contradiction in terms. Either you stick to the main roads and form one of a procession, bonnet to tail, reaching from Land's End to John O'Groats, or else you take to the byroads and rattle your car to ruin over ruts and potholes until it's not worth anyone's while to salvage the remnants. The roads at the present moment are a pleasure to drive on, but as it's past midnight, that fact can hardly be taken as a criterion of their state during the rush hours. To be relieved of the burden of coping with timetables." So in other words, very much a sense that there were too many vehicles. What on earth somebody like Mr. Vernon would make of the situation today? One hesitates to ask. Anyway, his driver, Chief Inspector MacDonald, Lorack's hero, adds a social dimension to commentary. And Chief Inspector MacDonald is a character that sort of represents the true Britishness of a steadiness, and he always gets his man or woman. Opinions nowadays are derived from two sources. One source is the car owner class hogs to a man. The other is the pedestrian class, the backbone of England, the fellows who get the work done and who can't own a car. Rather interesting that. In other words, cars are clearly sort of a matter of the middle class and a bad thing. And that reminds us that transport always has a social dimension. But that doesn't mean that in this period, the alternative to the car was the train, because as I've already indicated, the alternative to the car, both in cities and the countryside, was generally the bus. Anyway, major roads that had been overshadowed during the age of rail, such as the London-Brighton route via Crawley, revived in importance. Less prominent Victorian byroads had frequently been poorly surfaced, but greater traffic flow led to pressures to improve them, not least by providing all-weather surfaces. In 1909, the National Road Board was founded to lend energy and cohesion to road construction. However, roads that weren't adopted by county councils were neither asphalted nor looked after, and rapidly became tracks that were not accessible to cars. And that, it ought to be said, remains the situation today, that there are many roads that are not adopted and have shrunk into being sort of green tracks. The new roads led to new smells and sounds and affected the visual context of life, both in towns and in the countryside. Roads created new demands for signs, for lampposts, for manhole covers, and for traffic lights. They led to new boundaries and commands, to zebra crossings and to Belisha beacons, the second named after Leslie Hoare Belisha, the Conservative Minister for Transport. And by 1941, there were 64,000 Belisha beacons. These days, you can't imagine most local government getting itself around organising that. This popular engagement with road transport brought many casualties, in part due to the commitment to speed. The ending of the 20-mile-an-hour speed limit in 1930 caused an increase in fatalities, with the absence of regulation about car maintenance, there was no equivalent to an MOT, a contributing factor. And in 1934, there were 7,343 road deaths and 261,603 injuries were recorded, with pedestrians accounting for half of the casualties. The government responded with the 30-mile-an-hour limit in the built-up areas, the driving test, the Belisha beacon, and a rewritten highway code, all of which were passed by the national government. It was accused of, quote, pampering pedestrians, but the ideas of control and constraint became established before the wartime pattern of enforcement of the blackout and everything else during World War II. Design changes were also important to reduced casualties. A major cause of fatalities had been open cars in which drivers were liable to break their necks if the car turned over. And that was, of course, stopped by putting cars with roofs. And the other one was windscreens shattering and sort of sharp pieces of glass coming in and sort of lacerating people. And that was replaced by shatterproof glass. Another aspect was the more extensive use of pavements, at least in towns. And this was an instance of the degree to which transport segregation was a key to safety. So zebra crossings became a regulated aspect of such segregation. Travel by road, of course, is very different to travel by rail. It leads to the need for individual decisions which are not required when making journeys by rail. You can't take the train where you want it to go, as road transport offers access at every point along the road. There's also a need for fuel, for accommodation, for refreshment and information, both en route and for planning. This led in 1905 to the first national rail atlas for cars, Pratt's Road Atlas of England and Wales for motorists. The Automobile Association, the AA, in turn commissioned atlases, including from 1925, set itineraries along the major roads in the editions of the AA Road Book of England and Wales. And I can remember those when I was a child. A to Z street atlases followed from 1936, with Phyllis Pearsall playing the key role, notably in checking the streets of London. These A to Zs were a great commercial success and focused on transport to the exclusion of other elements. In the A to Zing of life, differences within the city or town, for example, of wealth or environment or housing quality or the presence or absence of them, were ignored. Political canvassers, estate agents, salesmen, police officers and residents are always aware and were aware at the time of detailed variations among the streets, of a geography of zones and boundaries, of ownership and residence patterns that do not appear on any street plan. But the point about these street plans was that they were fit for purpose and increasingly households needed to have them. Improvements to the road infrastructure of England included in 1934 what was then the longest underwater tunnel in the world, the road link under the Mersey between Liverpool and Birkenhead. Devised in 1929, began in the 30s in part to improve speed, notably for freight, and resumed in the 50s, the Trunk Roads programme prefigured the motorways in providing major changes to traditional local road patterns. Indeed, the programme anticipated the motorway system that opened from 1958, not least in an earlier use of the word motorway. The trunk road system was also used in the 30s as a way to offer employment. To that extent, there was a parallel with the German autobahns, and major roads like the London to Southend Road were improved under the trunk roads programme. There was also plans for bold road development, especially those focused on London. Sir Charles Bressey, a Ministry of Transport engineer, proposed a programme of massive building, including large roundabouts and big flyovers. In the late 1930s, more fantastically, the Modern Architectural Research Group envisaged huge raised arteries, more than 200 feet wide, crossing London at rooftop level, carrying trains and buses, while the streets below were to be handed over to private cars. It's worth noting that some of the World War II plans looked to the example of these groups. So Patrick Abercrombie's County of London plan of 1943 proposed a large number of new roads for London, including three orbital routes, as well as radial roads to join these rings and to provide links from the centre to the major trunk routes in southeast England. Abercrombie's Greater London Plan of 1944 proposed six ring roads, including E Ring, much of which is now followed by the M25, as well as 10 radial roads. Abercrombie argued that fast through traffic must be separated in order to protect local communities. The reality, of course, is that local communities were to be segregated as if they were walled in by these roads. These plans foreshadowed the Greater London Council's commitment in the 1960s and 1970s to a motorway box for London. And it's worth bearing in mind that post-war reconstruction in the late 40s was to focus on road flow. Other people also, though for different reasons, were seeking to use the roads to push through their vision for social change. So I read some documents by V.F. Soothill, marvellous name, who was the medical officer for Norwich in the interwar years. He complained about the increase in cars in Norwich, whose, quote, offensive gases, as he put it, made some of the streets smell at times like, quote, like the omnibus station outside Liverpool Street Station in London, clearly a stage in the route to hell. As a result, Soothill argued that the streets of Norwich City's centre should be built as wide as possible, so that, quote, the wind has free entry either to remove the fumes rapidly or to hasten the oxidation of any carbon monoxide to the less poisonous dioxide. So in other words, this sort of Washington in East Anglia was to have these wide boulevards laid on. Not much concern about how many of the locals were going to have to be, you know, sort of bulldozed out of the way. It's worth bearing in mind that road use within towns owed much to commuting, to the need of which increased greatly with the movement of people from some of the crowded city centres of the period of the 20s and 30s, including London, with a lot of people moving into the broader London area. Often the cars and the buses fed rail commuting, which had increased in scale as cities expanded and rail networks developed in the suburbs. So the suburbia is very much taken further in the interwar years, and cars are important in that. On the other hand, Autocar estimated that 1936 that 60% of Britons couldn't afford to run a car, even if one were given to them free. And I think that's an important point. We emphasise suburbia, but for many people, suburbia meant the bus and the train and walking to the train station and not the car. In 1914, there had been 132,000 motorised vehicles in private ownership in Britain. The comparable French number, incidentally, was 107,000. In the interwar period, those who couldn't afford cars were in the overwhelming majority, but vehicle ownership became a goal or model for many of them, creating a pent-up aspiration and ensuring that future affluence would lead to the purchase of more cars. And the cinema, both the British films shown on it, but actually more particularly the American films shown on it, helped to foster this romance. So also with fiction. Although he could go by train on visits, albeit with a car, classically collecting his luggage at the station, P.G. Wodehouse's fictional Bertie Wooster, a wealthy young man, is readily able to, quote, go on a motor trip and can drink plentiful brandy before driving. This was very much, you know, the basis. I mean, Bertie Wooster doesn't have any serious accidents, but you have to note the way in which his characters are depicted as driving is quite astonishing. Accidents, incidentally, though, in fact, were to increase in World War II because although there were fewer cars, the blackout caused many difficulties, as indeed is also the case with the trains of the period. If you look at by the 1940s, you can see government control, you can see obviously serious restrictions on the use of motor cars because of control over petrol. A lot of the vehicles going, including all the vehicles having accidents, are of course lorries. You can also see a gender dimension to transport continuing. So, for example, in 1949, cars were registered in the name of 13% of men, but only 2% of women. And you can also see a sense of tension between motorists and often the local population, whether they were walkers, cyclists, people that got on buses, people that got on horses. Going back to Lorac again, she lived in the Lancashire area of Lunesdale in North Lancashire, and writing about that in her novel, The Theft of the Iron Dogs, which was published in 1946, she wrote, quote, "The gradient was so steep that the roadway, though marked on the Ordnance Survey as a thoroughfare, was impossible for any wheeled traffic except farm carts, and even for these it was a heavy pull. Had the gradient been less steep, motor tourists from Lancaster and the Lake District would certainly have taken advantage of access to the River Lune. As it was, there was no metalled road. Motorists as a race do not like hilly walking. Giles Hoggett," that's a fictional character, "had sometimes watched with pleasure when some advantageous driver had risked a partial descent of the brow. Their outfits could be rescued by a couple of stout farm horses towing them in reverse. Apart from that, only a caterpillar tractor could deal with the situation." And indeed, in much of the country, road transport was still restricted. Walking and cycling was, was influential. And the car, indeed, petrol remained rationed until May 1950. And about from June 1948, about 90 miles monthly was allowed. So, you know, not an enormous amount was possible. And I think it's worth to say that it was a period of the late 40s, the grind of austerity very much set the note for transport, including in particular road transport. In John Dixon's Cars novel, He Who Whispers of 1946, he referred to a country still recovering from war with, quote, erratic buses, with taxis and cars short of petrol, with post-blackout motor car lamps odd in newness, and with train journeys similar in their misery. So I want to stop at that point because we'll go on to the second half of the century next time. But I wonder if there are any questions or things that you would like to raise for that, my good friend, Graham.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremy. There certainly are many different avenues we could go down. What I want to start with is the role of buses, not buses in town, but buses going longer journeys, sort of charabang buses. And I'm wondering how competitive, I mean, the 1920s and 1930s, how competitive these charabang trips. City to city or day jaunts into the weekend jaunts into the countryside are compared to using the train. If one was, let's hypothetically say, taking either a train or a charabang from central Birmingham out to Coventry for the day, let's say. How competitive would those have been? And also, was there much consolidation between rival bus companies during this period, as they tried to take on the trains, or was it very fragmented with just lots and lots of regional and family businesses dominating?
Well, I mean, as far as the latter is concerned, it was both. There was some consolidation, not least because a lot of the buses were linked to the railway companies, and there was, of course, major consolidation of the railway companies in the early 1920s, into the Big Four. But also, as you correctly say, there were many small companies, and it was quite easy to run a excursion service or to attract particular contracts, for example, moving workers to particular industrial plants, and running company buses accordingly. So there was a very variegated situation. Now, your next question, the competition. Well, by the very nature of things, the trains were better at rapid major town centre to major town centre. They were much less good at moving off that network. I'm not saying they couldn't do it some places, because in some places there were small rural lines. But obviously, on the small rural lines, services were more infrequent. So, in many senses, if you're going to go from Birmingham to Coventry, you've got a choice there. If you're going from the centre of Birmingham to the centre of Coventry, go by train. If you're going from, as it were, a more dispersed part of the Birmingham conurbation, which and you don't want to have to take one go to the local train station, take a train into the centre of Birmingham, change, etc., etc., I would think more readily about catching a bus. And the bus system was often more flexible and less expensive.
Was there a snobbery about taking the bus? I mean, there often is now, taking a bus long distance is seen as is the cheaper option to taking a train. Was that also the case then? What do we see particularly in novels of the time or journalism of the time, people looking down on the takers of the charabang as against the train, or is that a much more modern snobbery?
That's again a very good question. I think it's fair to say that there was a degree of snobbery. I mean, again, if you think of detective fiction, both Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple, Jane Marple, take the bus, but the bus is more associated with Jane Marple, and Hercule Poirot is more associated with the train. I think it's fair to say that the local gentry would have a car, just as their predecessors would have had a carriage. So I would say that yes, there might well be considered to be a pejorative element, but bear in mind that as far as trains were concerned, trains also had what were known as workmen's trains. Trains taking people to industrial or commercial employment, and those were scarcely matching social norms. And I described in my brief history of London the tension over the timing of trains and the way in which genteel people, particularly though not only ladies, going up to town didn't want to share from the suburbs, didn't want to share their trains with workers who were taking advantage of a cheaper service. And the structuring and organisation of the trains very much reflected this.
We have for most of the interwar period either conservative governments or national governments, of which most MPs are conservative in the coalition. Do we see a coherent policy between these different governments of the interwar period in terms of the attitude towards road and road traffic? Or you know, between Macdonald and Baldwin and Chamberlain, do we see changes in policy, you know, favouritism either towards the roads or the railways? Or was there no obvious favouritism in this period before the railways were nationalised?
Oh, that's a very good question. That is a toughie. I mean, what I would say is that the principal problem for many politicians was how to respond, as I think I've already indicated, to the unions. And rail was seen very much as a problem because of that. On the other hand, large number of members of the middle class owned shares in rail, members of the middle class who voted Conservative owned shares in rail companies. And the profitability of these rail companies was an issue. Now, as you may know, there is government legislation, and I discuss it in my history of rail. There is government legislation in the interwar period on the railways. And, you know, there are different ways of looking at that as to whether you think that the government could have been more or less favourable. The classic thing railway enthusiasts always argue is that roads get benefiting from the subsidy that, you know, they're provided by the state, whereas railways have to provide their own rail bed. And on top of that, the railways were affected by things like cheap trains legislation. In other words, the obligation to ensure that there were cut price trains. So the Cheap Trains Act of 1883 and the way that was kept, that legislation maintained. So, the railways felt that there were serious problems. They felt that the railway managers, many of them were unhappy about the Railways Act of 1921, the new wages board, the eight-hour day that had come in, and they felt that they should have been treated more favourably. And you can see that point of view because in the interwar period, you know, 240 miles of track, 350 stations were closed completely. And, you know, there was a lack of profit. There is in 1933 a Road and Rail Traffic Act, but as far as the railways are concerned, it provides inadequate assistance for the railways. And I would say I think that's a reasonable view on their part. On the other hand, it's not quite clear, as with today, what would have been the value of putting in significantly more investment in the face of, you know, trade unions that were, quite frankly, not particularly helpful. One could be much stronger than that. So I'm not quite sure where one wants to go with this. The roads don't have a central constituency other than the county councils who are responsible for them. And in many senses, they're starting from a more limited base, not limited in the sense of mileage, but limited in the sense of the bed and the quality of the road bed is often more inadequate. And from that perspective, they do quite well. And of course, roads have the great attraction that although there are maintenance issues, there are and in fact, quite serious maintenance issues on roads, as we know today with potholes, or just look round Exeter, as I was noticing yesterday. Nevertheless, rail maintenance is a much more serious problem and much more expensive. So I think it's fair to say that from the country's point of view, the expansion of the road network, the way in which individual portions of road could be used for cycles, for cars, for buses, for lorries, That actually, and indeed for that matter, for trams and trolleybuses, though those had to have additional provision, all of that is quite important and quite impressive.
It is. And there's just a final question that occurs to me. And again, I'm talking about the 1920s and 30s here. So people drive around, they park their car, they just park their car outside their house or outside their office or outside the cinema or wherever they're going. Or has someone in local government got round to inventing the car park yet? When does the car park, the municipal car park, begin to take off as an idea?
Well, parking is not a new problem because parking obviously is an issue for when you've got carriages and when you've got wagons. And as you will know, the basic infrastructure there is the provision of the horses and the supply of the horses. So classic parking was often, if you like, for that was often these large inns, which in turn become the basis of the roadhouses of the 1920s and 30s, where you can park your vehicles. Then separate to that, you get the development in the 20s and 30s of lorry parks. And those are quite important. And the point, the basic thing you're providing there is not just space, you're providing security because theft from lorries was an issue. So you're providing security. As far as building car parks in urban centres are concerned, that's less prominent in this period than it's going to become subsequently. But there are spaces that you can use in what we would call, I suppose, brownfield sites in urban areas. It classically, of course, deindustrialised, in other words, closed. The yards of closed factories, the yards of closed commercial premises, and the roadside in front of on major roads within urban spaces. So there's a fair amount of parking. And as I think I mentioned, we're only talking about 2 million vehicles by the end of the 30s. The large number of those are owned by people who have their own parking in their homes. We're talking about people that live in the suburbs and will then drive to their offices because it tends to be people that are relatively senior and driving to their offices. They will be able to park there. That would be something they will expect. They will have a named parking place with their name painted onto it.
Well, that's a privilege that is still awaiting me. But Professor Jeremy Black, talking about so many interesting things about the 20th century that we often either take for granted or simply don't think about at all. Thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure. And I hope people who were interested in my train series have got hold of my new history of rail published by Amberley. All the best.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.